Last week we finished our study, completed our study of Book 10, and we read the first section of Book 11, which is one long canto. Examination of Book 10. There was a discussion about an asura who ate himself up, and I've done a little research about that. Actually, there are two. The one that Chitra mentioned last week, Bhasma Asura. In the Puranic dictionary, it says there's no mention of this demon in any of the Sanskrit Puranas, but the Shiva Lila Amrita in Marathi contains the following story about him. Bhasmasura was born of the dust or ashes on the body of Shiva. Pleased at the great devotion of the demon towards him, Shiva asked him to name any boon he wanted. Bhasmasura said that he wanted the power to burn to ashes anybody on whose head he placed his hand. Bhasmasura became a nightmare to the whole world. Then Mahavishnu appeared before him in the form of Mohini, an attractive dancer. Alluring him with her charms, she asked him to join her in a dance called Mukta Nritya. During the course of this dance, Bhasmasura had to place his hand on his own head, and the moment he did so, he was burnt to ashes. This story of Mohini and her dance, it also appears in the story of the churning of the ocean. But anyway, that is Bhasmasura. But what I was thinking of, what I wanted to speak of, but I couldn't remember his name, is Kirtimuk. Kirtimuk was created by Shiva to eat up demons. One day, there were no demons left to eat. He felt hungry. What to do? Shiva told him, eat yourself. He ate himself up, starting from the tail, until only his head was left. Touched by such obedience, Shiva declared that the head of Kirtimuk should be displayed at the entrance to every one of his temples, and only those who paid homage to him should be allowed to enter. So at the entrance to every Shiva temple, there's a representation of Kirtimuk, which means glorious head, or head of glory. So.
Would everybody please turn off their mobile phone?
Yeah,
please. Last week we looked at Mother's map,
yeah.
And Narendra wasn't here. So you can see me about it after the class.
Shadavani, reading some part of the ten, I have a question. May I?
Yes.
In page 666, in 914,
one day man too shall know thy fathomless heart of silence and the brooding peace of night and grave obedience to eternal law and the calm, inflexible pity in thy gaze. This is the Supreme Divine Mother speaking to death.
Yeah.
What is your question, Anandi?
My question is, what does it mean that one day you are going to, that's death, no? I feel a contradiction.
What she had said was,
she
said, live death a while. Be still my instrument. And then as a kind of follow-up to that, she says that there's something positive, that death has a real mission to do. And one day, men will understand and know that mission. One day, man too shall know thy fathomless heart of silence. That gift that death gives, the brooding peace of night. And his other quality is grave obedience to eternal law. In the Indian tradition, the god of death, Yama, is also the god of law, of justice, of correct behavior, dharma. And that quality of his is very prominent in the original legendary version of Savitri. It's because Savitri herself is so obedient to eternal law and understands so well what the eternal law is that in the end he is forced to give her back Satyavan.
These divine
qualities. Yes? And the other quality of his is pity. The calm, inflexible pity in thy gaze. That he's looking on the earth with great compassion. I don't know whether here I can share a story that was told to somebody to me about a personal experience. This person was very much troubled by this figure of death, particularly the figure of death in the poem. And she was carrying with her a question about who are you and what are you doing and why do you cause so much suffering? And one night in dream, Yama came to her and said, what are you talking about suffering? I don't take away anybody. The people come to me and beg me, please give me your peace. So there's that aspect too. The souls come, not the people. The souls come. So.
It's also the song of death in the Schubert, death in the meat, she cries for pity. No, I'm not here. I will take care of it.
Yes. Okay, so shall we go on to book 11 then? We have read the first canto. Now we'll go through it sentence by sentence, or short passage by short passage. We can read on this side today. Patty, would you begin?
The Book of Everlasting Day. The eternal day, the soul's choice, and the supreme consummation. A marvelous sun looked down from ecstasy skies on worlds of deathless bliss, perfection's home. Magical unfoldings of the eternal smile, capturing his secret heartbeats of delight. God's everlasting bounded her. Domains appeared of sempiternal light, invading all nature with the absolute joy. Her body quivered with eternity's touch. Her soul stood close to the founts of the infinite. Infinity's finite fronts she lived in, new forever to an ever-living sight.
Thank you. Savitri, pursuing death, taking away the soul of Satyavan, has passed through the world of everlasting night and has passed through two twilights, the dream twilight of the ideal and the dream twilight of the earthly real. And now she has passed on into a new world, the world of everlasting day. It's a completely new realm, and it's ruled by this marvelous sun, which, like our sun with its planets, is shining down these planets. These dependencies of that sun are worlds of deathless bliss, perfection's home. And in those worlds, the manifestation, all the forms and beings and creatures and happenings are magical unfoldings of the Eternal's smile. And they capture his delight, his throbbing heartbeats of delight. She feels herself surrounded by God's everlasting day. And there the realms, the domains that she sees, they are ruled by this sempiternal night, light. Eternal, we know the meaning of eternal, it's endless. Sometimes it is intensified with the addition of this sempi. Semper in Latin means always, forever. So forever eternal light. And this light fills all the nature manifestation there with the absolute's joy. So Savitri is quivering with delight as she feels the touch of eternity. Her soul is standing close to the founts of the infinite. I think it doesn't mean the source of the infinite. It means that the infinite is the source which is pouring out like a fountain all these worlds. And her life, that is, her soul, is standing near to the infinite, which is pouring out like a fountain its possibilities, blissful possibilities. And her life, her being, including her subtle body, is living in infinity's finite fronts, the borders through which the infinite is expressing itself in form, in finite movements and beings, forms, events. And those finite fronts of infinity are full of ever new freshness. Everything is new and fresh and full of wonder to an ever-living sight. Would you read?
Eternity multiplied its vast self-look, translating its endless mightiness and joy into delight souls playing with time could share in grandeur's ever newborn from the unknown depths. Empowers the lived immortal from unknown heights. In passionate heartbeats of an undying love, in scenes of a sweet bliss that can never fade, immortal to the rapturous heart and eyes. In surreal arches of a translucent calm. From wonder's dream masks, cloudless skies slip down. An abyss of serpents, sunlight visited eyes, which suffered without pain the absolute rain, and saw immortal clarities of form. Twilight and mist were exiles from that air. Night was impossible to such radiant heavens.
Thank you. Anybody would like to ask or share anything about this passage? Yes, I think the pictures are here.
An abyss of sapphire, sunlight visited eyes. What is the abyss of sapphire?
Well, you have to go back to line 20. Yeah. It's as if he's describing the sky of that world. And he says that sky is like a series of arches that are very, very serene, calm, no? But the sky seems to come down in its arch and touch the horizon. So this sliding down of the skies, that blue of the skies, it's like it going into a very, very deep place. An abyss is the deepest part of the ocean. This is not the deepest part of the ocean. It's the deepest part of the sky. And sapphire is, of course, such a clear, transparent, special, living and vivid blue. And in that situation, there's this sunlight, this ever-living sunlight. But the eyes don't get tired with the brilliance of that sunlight. No, they can accept without pain that absolute ray, that sunlight which is so pure and clear and powerful, and the eyes can see forms, absolute immortal clarities of form, because they are flawless, they are immortal. So there's no such thing as twilight and mist. She has emerged from these worlds of the double twilight. The first twilight, the twilight, the half light, and the mist was very, very beautiful and full of promise and suggestion and hope. And the second twilight, the twilight of the earthly real, was much more oppressive and cloudy and dark. But there's no possibility of twilight or mist in that radiant air. Maybe no possibility of night even. Yes, Ganga Lakshmi.
Maybe last Sunday you tell about Jamina. I saw immortal clarity of form. Maybe his design is some clarity of form.
Her designs perhaps are an attempt to capture something, some moments of those immortal clarities of form. Thank you, Ganga Lakshmi.
But he touched me when you remember this aspect. But I am very touched when I see the picture.
Yes, yes. There anybody who would like to see these wonderful, they are drawings mostly, there are only a few paintings of Janina. We have the book in our library. It's called A Captive of Her Love, and it's about the an artist who lived in the ashram, Janina. And last week we mentioned her mother's comments after her passing, that she had captured partially, some partial glimpse of some of the forms of the new manifestation.
You may borrow the book.
Hmm? You can't borrow books from our library. You can look at them there. But perhaps it's in the Oroville Library. Most probably it's there. Night was impossible to such radiant heavens. For us, it's hard to imagine being in a world where night is impossible, where you have to live always in the full brilliance of the absolute ray. Yes, Don?
I am a creature of this earth, and so I'm very much annoyed by the fact that there's no rain and nothing is growing. Clouds are wonderful things.
Yes. But clouds can sometimes come rain can sometimes come out of cloudless heavens. I'm sure in this world they get all the rain that they need.
And they can come at night, the rain, and that's wonderful.
But there's no night. No, I don't think it means that. You will see as we read on that there is a progression. This is in the manifestation still, even if it's only a symbol world. So there is a progression, there is change. Amitoj, would you go on?
Firm in the bosom of immensity, spiritual breaths were seen, sublimely born from a still beauty of creative joy. Embodied thoughts, the sweet dimensions, held to please some carelessness of divine peace, answered the deep demand of an infinite sense and its need of forms to house its bodiless thrill. A march of universal powers in time, the harmonic order of self's vastitude, in cyclic symmetries and metric planes, harbored a cosmic rapture's revelry, an endless figuring of the spirit in things, planned by the artist who has dreamed the world of all the beauty and the marvel here, of all time's intricate variety. Eternity was the substance and the source, not from a plastic mist of matter made. They offered the suggestion of their depths and opened the great seas of their powers.
Thank you. Throughout this poem, we are touched, moved, thrilled by Shobindo's poetic mastery, his mantric expression, his amazing imagery. But I am feeling, I noticed when we came to this book, this canto, in the English of Savitri classes on Thursday afternoons a few weeks ago, the quality of the poetry in this book is something, again, completely beyond. I think this is probably, we could say, this is Sri Aurobindo's supreme poetic achievement appears in this book. You can notice the difference in quality, and it's not, because of that, it is less easily accessible to our mental understanding than other parts. I mean, throughout the poem there are baffling things, and Mother says that Savitri is occult knowledge and spiritual experience, and it needs the same experience and knowledge to be understood. But we have found that much of the poem is somehow accessible to our, at least to our imagination, to our receptive higher and inner mentality. Otherwise, we wouldn't be so moved or touched by it. But here it's much more difficult to use any other words than the words that he has used to convey the meaning or the sense. Nevertheless, we can try if anybody wants to ask. Yes. Breadths. This is connected with the word broad, which is another way of saying wide. No? Breadths, broad, open spaces, wide, vast spaces. These spiritual spaces are held firm, they are supported, protected in this bosom of immensity springing from the infinite.
What's a spiritual breath?
It's line 43, not from plastic mist, the metal was made.
Yes.
Not from plastic mist, metal was not made from, the form was not made by matter.
They were not made like our forms, which are, he says, are made from a plastic, that means easily molded, flexible mist of matter. We can talk about the mist of matter if we think like the physicists, that 90% of all Earth matter is empty space, in fact, and in it there's this mist of particles that appear to our senses as solid. So he says those forms there were not made of matter, and so they are not surfaces, they are not appearances. These eternity was the substance and the source of all these products. These forms, at the top he mentions some forms, that these forms are actually embodied thoughts. And they are given some dimension, some shape.
But not from matter.
But not from matter, no. They are embodied thoughts. And they've been given these forms to answer the deep demand of an infinite sense. Our senses are limited. We use them to connect our consciousness with the things that are outside us, that we perceive as objects. But the use of this infinite sense is pure delight. And these forms that are created by this still beauty of creative joy, they take these forms to provide delight to that infinite sense. And then he mentions some of these forms that this creative joy takes. Universal forms, a march of universal powers in time. So in that world there is time and there is space and there are cosmic powers as there are here in our universe. And these are expressing the harmonic order of self's vastitude. This is all being held in the consciousness of the one self, its vastness, its vastnesses, and it's held in the form of cyclic symmetries that recur. There's a rhythm of recurrence and metric planes. There are planes of existence, just as there are in our universe. And these planes are, it's not that they're measured in meters, they are measured in meters, in rhythms. And these forms are harboring a cosmic rapturous revelry. They express and house divine delight, universal delight. They are an endless figuring of the spirit in things. The indwelling spirit is expressing itself in all these forms. And all these forms, this endless figuring, is being planned by the artist who has dreamed the world. Of all the beauty and the marvel here in that realm, of all time's intricate, immensely detailed variety, eternity was the substance and the source. And because they were not made from a plastic mist of matter like the forms that we know, they can offer the suggestion of their depths. What is the deep suggestion or the many deep suggestions that are being held in the depths of these forms? And they open up and reveal the great series, the amazing hierarchy and variety of their powers. I think it's referring to the word forms in line 34. And he's given examples in the succeeding lines. He's given examples of some of the different kinds of forms that are there. Yes, it is to give delight to some aspect of divine peace, and that is completely free of anxiety and care and worry of any kind. No? So the forms give delight and variety and enjoyment to that divine peace.
So it means carefree.
I think it means carefree
rather than carelessness
in our usual sense. Yeah. Yeah. I think so. Shall we go on, Stefania?
Arisen beneath a tribal mystic heaven, the seven immortal earths were seen, sublime, homes of the blessed. Released from death and sleep, where grief can never come, nor any pain, arriving from self-lost and seeking worlds, altered heaven nature's changeless quietude, and mighty pose full of eternal calm, its pose of ecstasy in the world. Plains that seem the expanse of white sleep, thoughts wings climb up towards heaven's vast repose, lost in blue deeps of immortality. A changed earth nature felt the breath of peace. Air seemed an ocean of felicity, on the couch of the unknown spiritual rest, a vast quiescence swallowing up all sound, into a voicelessness of utter bliss. Even matter brought a close spiritual touch, all thrilled with the immanence of one divine. The lowest of these earths was still a heaven, translating into the splendor of things divine, the beauty and brightness of terrestrial scenes.
Thank you.
Puzzled by these numbers, triple.
Yes. No, I was wondering whether anybody who's, we've read this, whether anybody's taken any notes.
What is
the triple mystic heavens and the seven immortal earths.
I thought
you might.
The note I have is Mother's cosmic map.
Oh, yeah, that's what we looked at last week.
Seven immortal earths and three mystic heavens are possibly in the Indian tradition, referred to in the life divine. This is all I've written.
So what we have to imagine is a universe or a solar system, we can say, organized around this sun. I think I'm correct in saying that our Earth atmosphere actually has several levels, doesn't it? So in a similar way, the atmosphere around these seven earths, these planets, whatever they are, has layers. And perhaps these correspond to Sat and Chit and Ananda. Maybe. And then the seven immortal earths, these are bodies of substance. He will describe the landscapes and the nature of these earths. They are immortal earths. They are transformed earths, or earths that don't need to be transformed, that already enjoy the perfection that the divine life will bring to this earth. And perhaps there are seven of them because of these seven principles of existence that Sri Aurobindo refers to in the life divine, the ascending series of substance. That's all I can say.
If we take the inner representation of these outer perfect earths, then and also the Sat, Chit and Ananda, then can we also relate to, like, if we say that they are inside us also, because what is inside is outside, then are these the chakras, the seven earths, the seven chakras, and Sat, Chit and Ananda around me?
Yes, but in a, these are in a transformed state, not the state that we experience at present on Earth.
After the transformation.
They don't even need to be transformed. They've always been there in their perfection. And the fact that we can aspire towards the perfection of the planes of existence that we know and the planes of substance that we know is because of the existence of those perfect forms of them in the everlasting day. Perhaps something like that.
But this should also be in us, because if they are not in us, we can never get them.
In us are there representations in the involved form. He says, if you have a look at book 2, canto 1, there definitely we are carrying within us these planes that are represented in Mother's cosmic map that we looked at last week. Humanity is the microcosm of this universe. But now she's entered into another realm beyond this universe, I think.
In the manifestation, but beyond this.
Let's just hold it, huh? So, but anyway, these seven immortal earths are the homes of the blessed. They're like a kind of heaven, of paradise, no? The blessed who've been released from death and sleep. They are worlds where grief can never come, and no pang, no pain coming from other worlds, self-lost and seeking worlds like our own, can come there and alter that changeless quietude of the heaven nature that prevails there and its mighty posture of eternal calm. And then Sri Aurobindo starts to give us hints of the landscapes of those earths. Plains lay that seemed something like the vast expanse of God's wide sleep. Their skies, thoughts, wings like birds climbed up towards a sky which is also expressing vast repose, lost in blue deeps of immortality. Their earth nature is changed and feels the breath of peace. The air itself seems an ocean of felicity, of bliss, or the resting place of the unknown spiritual rest, the support. And there's a silence, a vast quiescence that swallows up all sound into a voicelessness of utter bliss. And there's some kind of matter there, even matter brought a close spiritual touch, not this hard surface that we normally experience. Everything in those worlds is thrilled with the immanence, the sense of the indwelling presence of one divine. There are seven earths, but even the lowest of them was still a heaven. And in its forms it translates to the splendor of things divine, the beauty and brightness that we enjoy in earthly scenes, trees and flowers, sunlight falling on leaves, birds, and all the beauty we enjoy in terrestrial scene. Would you read on, Lorraine? Yes, it's kind of sacred.
So eternal mountains?
Yes, yes.
Eternal mountains live on gleaming ridge, whose lines were graved as on a sapphire plate, and etched the borders of heaven's lustrous moon. Climb like piled temple stairs, and from their heads a topless meditation heard below. The approach of a blue pilgrim multitude, and listen to a great arriving voice of the wide travel hymn of timeless seas. A chanting crowd from mountain bosoms slipped past branches fragrant with a sigh of flowers, hurrying through sweetnesses and level leaves. The numerous rivers of felicity, divinely rippled, honey-voiced desires, mingling their sister eddies of delight, then widening to a pace of calm lit muse, down many glimmered estuaries of dream, went whispering into lakes of liquid peace.
Thank you. It's a description of the beauty and brightness of terrestrial scenes translated into the splendor of things divine. One could paint it One could try to paint it. Huta has tried. There's a picture of it.
It's not an exhibition.
It's not an exhibition.
This is not.
Are we the pilgrim multitude?
I think so.
Why are we blue?
Because we're in the distance. Yes,
but now the artists with the computer animation and all that, they are managing to somehow express this. I saw a movie called Avatar.
Yes.
In that they are going into another world, second world, and this is so beautiful. And I saw a video clip of 2 minutes I would like to share with you, where the golden light is going from the heart and it ripples and it goes in all the dimensions. And it's already happening. I think the artists are not.
Well, I certainly hope that one day there will be some great artists with sufficient subtlety and contact with the higher and the deeper worlds to be able to picture at least some of this. Well, some skills are there. It's as you say, Avatar is amazing. But there's something about Huta's paintings, which are made with conscious brush strokes on canvas, expressing something of the mother's consciousness working through her, that is much subtler than any computer animation that I've seen so far. I'm not saying it can't happen.
I'll send this animation. When I saw that, I thought this is how the love should be.
Yes.
Yeah.
No, of course, there can be some symbolic representation. I'm not saying it's not possible. But yes, please send it to me. So far, I haven't seen anything that has that subtlety that is here in this language.
Two-dimensional. I know that she did amazing things. Now it's possible.
Mother was specially interested in the use of light. And she said the difficulty of using pigment is that it's pigment, it's not light. So, yes, I think in the future it will happen, yeah, for sure. Good.
It also depends on the eyes that see.
It's depending on the eyes that see. You are so right, Audrey. The eyes that see and on the consciousness that can express what is seen. That's the thing. Just yesterday I was reading a passage where Mother was speaking about the discipline of art. And she said, I don't see how it's different from yoga. You know, from yoga.
Oh, yeah.
That you have to learn to see and then to be able to express what is seen. And she says the discipline that the artist has to go through is very, very similar to the discipline of yoga.
And it doesn't necessarily mean that the artist has a concept of what is to be revealed.
No.
The artist has to see what.
But that what the artist sees depends on his state of consciousness.
Absolutely.
And then it's not only what is seen, it's also the power to express what is seen. As Sri Aurobindo, he says, the poet sees, it's a power of vision. He expresses what he has seen. But there are perhaps infinite levels of possibility of expressing what has been seen.
It's hard to say what comes first, but you can in the sense of creation.
Yes. But well, I feel fairly sure that the conception or the seeing comes first. And then if we want to materialize that conception and that seeing, we need a certain dynamic energy, and we need a command of harmony, and we need perfection.
That isn't my experience.
You mean your hand just gets directed by what has been seen?
No, I don't know what has been seen.
You find out through what you do, through what. So it's a process of discovery. Thank you.
I have from childhood a very big frustration with painting. I was doing photography because I said that I couldn't paint. When I arrived to Pondicherry, a painter said, let's do something together. And he was surprised for what I was doing. And at the same time, I read Shorobindo saying that we can do any kind of art because it's here somewhere. Yeah. And if we contact, we can bring him down. And for me, it was an experience like that.
But Mother used to train the hands of people, no? To express what was the contact with those higher and deeper levels. But that's partly the utility of art to the artist, that it brings them in contact with their inner being, their deeper and higher levels of consciousness. But the utility of art to the world and to the future is this, what she spoke about in context of Janina, of contacting something that hasn't been manifested yet, which is waiting a future possibility and making a bridge between that and what is here. And it's in this way that art can shape and mold the future. Future realizations.
To share with the others.
Yes,
to
actually manifest in matter things that have been seen in the subtle world. Yeah.
We have to develop the facilities, but the inspiration comes from the higher plane, also the mother when she was the inspiration came, she was just...
But she was absolutely transparent. She could receive it and do it. And this is not true of just ordinary, untrained hands, no?
And consciousness.
And eyes, yes. That's what she mentions particularly, training of the eyes.
And I think that is where we, on this level, are so uneducated.
Yeah.
Schools don't care about.
Many of us do. Many of us really care. If we can't do it ourselves, we appreciate what you're able to do.
Yeah.
And if the appreciator isn't there, the artist isn't there.
Well, you can't see what I'm doing. You can't see what I'm doing. Because your eyes are not educated.
And what the artist does, like what the avatar does, doesn't depend on the audience. It's not quite correct what you say. Of course, in a material sense, it's like that. The artist needs an audience, needs a patron, a support.
I said there simply is appreciators, where those of us can see and appreciate
you,
to what degree and how manifest.
That puts you in contact with something in yourself.
Yeah.
There will be always a limitation, the tools you have in hand.
What?
The tools. He said about computer graphics. And of course, at that time, like paintings, you mix pigments, the light intensity goes down. If you mix light, intensity goes more. So, and like, likewise, for every tool which we, what we have consciously felt and what we can represent, there's always a difference.
Yes.
Then of course, difference between observables. All these limitations.
So, if you think about what Sri Aurobindo's doing here, I think it's unique in poetry. Poets have always used imagery to suggest things to us in their work. But what Sri Aurobindo is doing is using imagery not to make us see earthly things. He's at using imagery to express the subtler inner realities. Mm-hmm. And that's what Mother said that she was trying with Hutta's painting. She said there's a subtler reality that's much closer to the truth, and that's what we are trying to show you. And so if you concentrate your attention behind the image, then you can get a glimpse of what we're trying to communicate. So I think it's the same with the words. If we look at the words and we go from one word to the next and think about their literal meaning, it's unlikely to work very powerfully, no? But if we take a whole passage and it's subtle suggestions, it's subtle suggestions which are not only there in the imagery, but in the rhythm and in the suggestive sounds of the words. That's why Sri Aurobindo was always aiming to have the inevitable word in each particular place. You know, you can say carelessness, or you can say carefreeness. But perhaps for his purpose here, the sound of carelessness, to please some carelessness of divine peace, perhaps that's more effective than if he had said carefreeness, which is not a very musical word or suggestive word. So just let's check the picture again. The mountains, the lines of the mountains, it's as if they've been etched, very, very fine lines on a sapphire plate. This lustrous noon, which is the sky there, and they're rising up like temple stairs. And they're the tops, the peaks of the mountains, it's as if they are meditating even further, topless meditation. But coming up to them from below is the approach of this blue pilgrim multitude, all the souls who are climbing up. And listened to a great arriving voice. They can hear not only the sound of the pilgrim feet and perhaps the chanting of the pilgrims, they can also hear the sound of the ocean, the wide travel hymn of timeless sea. And these mountains have sides, mountain sides. No? So down the mountains are slipping streams, little streams. They make a lovely song. They travel down the mountain like a chanting crowd. They've sprung out of the bosom of the mountains, and they are passing through forests, past branches fragrant with a sigh of flowers. And they're hurrying through these sweetnesses, the sweetness of these lovely mountainside scenes. They're hurrying with revel leaps. It's fun for the streams to leap down the mountainside. No? And further down, they become rivers, murmurous rivers of felicity. And they are moving more slowly. They are divided just with ripples, little ripples. But there's also a sound, and that sound is speaking of honey-voiced desires, wonderful possibilities. And those rivers, they meet, they mingle. In India, rivers are females. They are sisters. The rivers are sisters. So when they meet, they mingle their eddies of delight. And then they widen out more into estuaries, into river mouths where they meet the ocean. They slow down to a pace of calm-lipped muse, like that smile of the Buddha. Down many glimmered estuaries of dream, where the rivers spread out, no? Went whispering into lakes of liquid peace. It's a wonderful picture. It's evoking a wonderful series of states of consciousness. We'll stop there for today. We can hear Mother reading some of these passages.
White forms where
Thanks to Sri Aurobindo.